This is Hot Tech with Jan Vermeulen.
Hello, Jan Vermeulen. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Very, very well, thank you. All right, so can we just talk about internet resources? What do you mean by internet resources?
So, simple terms, IP addresses. For those who haven't encountered them before, an IP address is actually an important but mostly invisible part of network communications, unless you're some kind of network engineer or have set up your own home network. You need an IP address to actually connect to the internet from your phone or, you know, at home. You need some kind of IP address to do that. And anybody who hosts, like websites and stuff, each of those web servers needs an IP address to communicate with them. So okay. It's kind of like, I guess you, in old fashioned terms, you can think of it as a postal address, that you can send messages back and forth. Or in modern terms, like a phone number for, I need a phone number for you to reach me, but you also need a phone number for me to reach you.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So these IP resources, there's an organization called AFRINIC, the African Network Information Center, which its sole purpose is to maintain a database of IP addresses that it was given by another organization called IANA. And it then keeps track of who it gives IP addresses to, how many IP addresses have been given out. That's what AFRINIC effectively does. You apply, if you need IP addresses, you apply to them, you make your case, and they decide whether or not you shall be given IP addresses. If you're an internet service provider or a web host, you know, that's where you get your IP addresses from, which we've now covered, you know, why you would need them. And what we found through a 5-month-long investigation is that the IP addresses within South Africa and in the African region in general that AFRINIC has jurisdiction over have been stolen and have been sold on the black market. Those IP addresses are, you know, now today worth around 800 million rand. Wow. But this has happened over a period from probably 2010 to 2016 that we've noticed this kind of fraudulent behavior. And what was more interesting is that I first wrote about this in September. And back then, we still kind of assumed that the AFRINIC database was accurate. And it looked like there were like a bunch of old South African companies who have had their IP address resources hijacked and then sold or traded or used by unscrupulous network operators for various unsavory purposes. But it turns out that assuming that the Whois database was accurate was a big mistake, because there was an insider in AFRINIC who helped themselves, at least one insider. It might have been multiple, but we've been able to tie it back to at least one person inside AFRINIC, very senior person. They helped themselves to what appears like the inventory of free IP addresses that AFRINIC has at its disposal to hand out and from which it generates an income. So this person just helped themselves to millions of rands worth of IP addresses, and we actually have an invoice, a bank instruction, a proof of payment, of this person being his company being paid for the IP addresses. We then went back, the company's registered in Uganda. We queried those documents, and this person and his immediate family, his wife and kids, are registered as the shareholders of the company to which this money was paid. So yeah, we followed the money all the way back to this person. And there's like, you know, 8 or 9 different lines of evidence pointing to this one person inside AFRINIC who has effectively aided and abetted digital colonization of AFRINIC, of African internet resources, because a large chunk, if not all of these, IP addresses are being used by overseas operators, and not African ones. We tied it back to one Dutch national and another Israeli national, who have been using these IP addresses. And that's not what Afrinet's policies are about. Its policies are to supply IP addresses for the benefit of the African continent, not for, you know, two unscrupulous network operators to enrich themselves, along with an insider in the organization himself.
Which leads me to my next question, Lan. Are there innocent businesses, and I say innocent businesses, people who legitimately bought these IP addresses?
Yes, yes, at least one, and that's part of the reason we were able to expose the story in the detail we did, is we received information from an industry source that a company, a South African, well, sort of South African company called TotalSend, they're an email provider, they've got offices in Cape Town, but they're incorporated in Mauritius. And they bought a block of IP addresses from this company, this Ugandan company, with so many fronts. Like getting into it will just confuse people. But like we pierce through the fronts, and it all traces back to this one Afrinet insider. And yes, they bought a block of IP addresses from this person. And based on the email exchanges we saw between TotalSend and the seller, who is probably this person because of the surnames and so on that track. It certainly looks like they were acting in good faith, and they weren't aware that they were buying stolen property. They thought it was a legitimate sale, and nothing looked fraudulent. So they went ahead, and they've been using these IP addresses for more than 5 years now, I think.
Wow.
And so it would be devastating for them to lose these IP addresses. Their whole business could be in jeopardy. And naturally, as a result of the article, they've put contingency plans in place to make sure that that doesn't happen. They're trying to apply for IP addresses from Afrinet, but it's an uphill battle.
So what recourse do they have?
Right. So, it depends on who we're talking about. So Afrinet's resource is to bring this insider up on criminal charges.
Yes.
For folks who have bought these IP addresses, they've generally got a better deal out of it, than if they had, gone to Afrinet, because in TotalSend's case, they paid $2,500 for their block of IP addresses up front, whereas they would have had to pay that and more per year to get the IP addresses legitimately from Afrinet. And so they've actually got a pretty good deal out of this, but they certainly wouldn't want to lose access to their IP addresses. And so their recourse there would be to communicate with Afrinet and try to argue that they should be allowed to keep this block of IP addresses. And, they would probably then be migrated onto like a proper Afrinet membership profile, and then have to pay their annual dues like they're supposed to, but at least they'd be able to keep their IP addresses. But yeah, Afrinet needs to deal with the problem internally. They said that they are busy conducting an internal investigation, but certainly the person responsible should be brought up on criminal charges. Whatever penalties, financial penalties go with that, because this person has cost them money, tremendous sums of money, of companies who, instead of being awarded IP addresses from Afrinet, which would then be annuity income for Afrinet, this vast inventory of IP addresses have been taken out of Afrinet's free pool and sold on. And that income has been denied to Afrinet for who knows how many years. It's going to be different from block to block. But it's a tremendous sum of money.
How many IP addresses are you talking about? I mean, do you have any idea?
Yes. So just the ones that we've tracked back to the free pool, it's going to be millions of IP addresses. I don't have the spreadsheet open in front of me right now, but it's millions and millions of IP addresses. And those alone, the last time I calculated, at about $20 per IP address, and a rand dollar exchange rate of 14.65, those came to over 300 million rand on their own. The ones that were taken, appeared to be taken, I should say, for the sake of 100% accuracy, from the Afrinet free pool. There could be some other explanation that, we just don't see, but it just seems the most likely explanation here. These IP addresses came from the Afrinet free pool. The remaining 500 million, is IP addresses that used to belong to other South African organizations, which have been stolen by the Whois records, the Whois database, the African Whois database being manipulated, and you know, these unscrupulous characters taking control of those IP address blocks and either leasing them, selling them on, or using them for whatever nefarious purposes they want to use them for.
Absolutely incredible. And do you think that this is the tip of the iceberg, or do you think that you've kind of got it down? That you understand
I do think this is the tip of the iceberg in terms of the people that are involved. So the evidence all points back to one person inside Afrinic who's kind of left holding the bag here. But certainly there's enough evidence to suggest that there are more people involved here than just that one. It's just a matter of finding that smoking gun evidence to tie other people to this fraud. So not the tip of the iceberg in terms of the extent of the fraud that's been committed. I think we've got that down. I think we've neatly enumerated all the blocks that have been stolen and squatted on and otherwise manipulated. But in terms of who else is involved, there's still a long story to tell there, I think.
All right. And just finally, before I let you go, because we have to take news headlines, Jan, how is this relevant to the yous and the me's? Are any of us likely to be affected by this?
Like
a man in the street, the us's.
Yeah. You know, you, me, everybody listening.
Right.
And the sad thing is, probably not all of this stuff is invisible to us, even though it's incredibly important. And so, yeah, at the end of the day, this is an internet governance issue that happens so far behind the scenes that almost no one cares about it. But it is so incredibly important. And as I said, it amounts to a form of digital colonialism that's happened right under our noses. And that's happened right under the noses of the people that's supposed to be protecting their resources from this. It might not have consequences for us now, but it would have had further down the line when we're going, hey, where did our IP resources go? And certainly it has consequences for the autonomy of the continent to look after its own internet governance matters, because the trust in Afrinic, as you can imagine, is incredibly thin. And if it continues to be eroded like it has been, then people aren't going to want to deal with Afrinic at all. And that might have dire consequences.
Jan Vermeulen, that is where we leave it this week. Thank you very, very much. Always interesting speaking to you, and look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Yes, thank you very much. Chat again soon, and may load shedding end quickly.
Yes. And I did want to talk to you about load shedding. In fact, if you can hold on and if you let me take news headlines, I would love to talk about this stage 8 that, can you hold on?
Sure thing.
Okay, great. That's Jan Vermeulen, editor at large for mybroadband.co.za. Fantastic, fantastic tech website. If you've got anything that you want to know about tech, then go and check it out. We're going to be talking about load shedding. What does that stage 6, stage 7, stage 8, all of that mean? Because something tells me that we need to know. Right now, though, let's find out what's in your next news bulletin. Get some news headlines.
All right. In your news headlines, the U.S. State Department has cancelled travel ban on Old City of Jerusalem. Israel's taxi driver returns $60,000 cash left in his cap. And Ramaphosa has cut his Egypt trip short to attend to electricity crisis. Catch full details at 5 o'clock.
Thank you very, very much. All right. Let's go back to Jan Vermeulen. Jan, my understanding of the load shedding, right, schedule, is that stage one is when you're out for an hour. Stage, and it saves 1,000 kilowatts. Megawatts. Stage two is 2 hours and it saves 2,000 megawatts and so on and so forth. Is that not how it works?
Not entirely, no. So the schedules are actually different from city to city. So when I was in Cape Town and load shedding hit for the first time this year, it was jarring how long certain parts of Cape Town were off, even during stage two load shedding, compared to places in Joburg and Tshwane. So depending on which metropolitan area you fall under and how they administer their power affairs, the times that you will be offline will be different. But what is accurate is that the stages go up in megawatt. So stage one is rotational load shedding of 1,000 megawatts, and that then goes up to stage eight, which is 8,000 megawatts. And so that's currently those are the schedules that the schedules that Eskom has already worked out, and that it has asked its distributors like City of Joburg, City Power, City of Tshwane, it's asked them to work out schedules so that when it announces stage one through stage eight, people can just refer to those existing schedules and know exactly when their power will be off. But beyond stage eight, they've said it's not that there are no plans in place. There's just no schedules in place, but they still have plans to be able to rotationally load shed beyond stage eight if you know things get that bad, to protect the power network from total collapse.
Yeah, which we certainly don't want, because you need
power.
I mean, that could actually run into months if the entire grid had to go down, because you need power to power up the grid.
And right. And so, I'm told that in South Africa, because of the amount of load shedding that's been happening in the past few years, Eskom has actually, looked into this and is better prepared than, you know, people might be in other countries where, yeah, you are looking at months of downtime, but you're certainly looking, even if it's not months of downtime in South Africa, it's certainly weeks, because to bootstrap the grid, literally from zero, you would have to go to a power plant and fire up a generator, use that generator to fire up a bigger generator to then drive things like conveyor belts and that sort of thing, so that you can feed the materials into the power plants, so that you can get like one power plant up, and then you use the power from that power plant to power up the next one and the next one and the next one and so forth until the whole grid is up. So the fact that we've got hydroelectric power helps with that, to help power the grid back up. It's called a black start, starting from, you know, no power in the grid at all, from black. But you just don't want to get in that situation, because if a country is left without power for weeks, that's definitely.
Well, you have no water, you have no internet, you have nothing.
It's very definitely a Moody's downgrade, like almost assuredly.
Sure. I think a Moody's downgrade would be the least of our problems if we have a total blackout. Jan.
Yes.
That said, I recently was on a road trip, and when we were driving through the Eastern Cape, through the Western Cape, we saw the most extraordinary thing. Massive wind farms.
Right.
I mean, these windmills are absolutely massive, and they are so graceful, and they're turning very, very slowly. They are just incredible. I mean, I got goosebumps when I first saw them. I thought South Africa has this. Now, I see that, they are due to come online, to reach full capacity, in November 2020, and they're going to add 2,300 kilowatts to the grid, which I think is just incredible. Not kilowatts, megawatts, whatever.
Is it megawatts? So 2,300 megawatts is definitely not nothing. The wind, like having wind power and solar power, projects ongoing it's very encouraging to hear. The thing to keep in mind though is that the wind is not a consistent source of power. And so you can't be too reliant on it, especially here in South Africa where we are struggling, right, to have a stable supplier of power to the country. And so that it might be 2,300 megawatts at full tilt, but if the wind dies down, then maybe you've only got 800 megawatts. And so you've got to make sure that you can make up that shortfall. If there's no wind for a while, then you can't rely on that power necessarily. And so, those kinds of things have to be taken into account when you build your energy budget for the country. So that, you can go great. We can save, on these more expensive forms of power generation and less renewable forms of power generation. And switch to wind when the wind is good, and then if the wind dies down, then we can quite easily switch back to something that's more reliable. And that can make up the shortfall that the wind doesn't provide.
Jan Vermeulen, that is where we unfortunately have to leave it. But thank you very, very much. And we'll chat to you soon. God bless.
Chat to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Next week. Keep up. Bye.
Bye-bye.